This is an RSA podcast. RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Rubbing shoulders with the Wigmore Hall, just north of London's Oxford Street, sits the discreet showroom, studio and headquarters of one of Britain's most respected fashion designers. For over three decades, Margaret Howe has established a highly individual reputation based on quality, attention to detail, and an understated approach to fashion, which has given her a global reputation, a CBE, and Royal Designer for Industry status. But her journey started at a jumble sale back in the early 70s, when she stumbled on a beautifully made vintage shirt. So taken by its well-crafted simplicity, it inspired her to embark on producing her own. The rest is history and a fascinating story. Well, I think I should start by saying to the listeners that we're sitting in your studio and shop in Wigmore Street, which you opened, I think, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's extremely discreet and has this lovely mix of your own work along with a lot of 20th century furniture, which I want to talk to you a bit about later. But before we talk about what you're doing now, I want to just go back a little bit. You grew up in the 50s.
Yes.
And I'm interested to know what your view was of that kind of post-war experience and what effect it had on you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, of course, not being aware of it being post-war at the time, but I had a very sort of happy, simple childhood, I think you'd say. My parents would always make our clothes. You know, my mother would make the clothes. My father grew the vegetables in the garden. We'd knit our own things, darn socks, all that sort of thing.
Mm.
Very much a sort of outdoor life as well, picnics in the country, and walks, and parents used to like to get away from the crowd. So
this was where were you?
Surrey.
Surrey, yes, that's
yes.
Right. Yes.
And yes, I think that sort of, there was always a strong sort of love of the countryside and sort of natural things and colours, which sort of now I realise sort of gets fed back in.
Yeah.
My early memories are quite strong sort of tactile memories of my father's sort of shirt that he used to garden in, and an old raincoat hanging in the garage. And again, that sort of fed back in when I was trying to make clothes that felt lived in rather than sort of rather sort of smart and straight off the hanger.
Mm. So what you said just a little bit earlier there was that your mother was very much into making clothes. So that was something that was very much passed on to you, because I know that as a small girl you were making your own clothes as well. Is that simply rather like mothers teaching daughters to cook at that time?
I think
you just naturally went to the sewing machine.
I think at that time nearly every house would have its sewing machine.
Yeah.
Whereas now perhaps it wouldn't be the case at all.
It's true, yeah.
Yes, she used to make our dresses, you know, little floral dresses and things. And but my middle sister also, she would start making her clothes before me, and then she would encourage me and so on. I think the thing of making things was we all made things. Well, my middle sister and I, we were both very similar in that we both loved drawing and painting and went to art school. But we'd always be making things, whether it was toy theatres or little miniature gardens, embroidery, anything.
So was it just the two of you, or did you have
a third sister? Yes.
And were you all sort of creative, do you think?
Or? My eldest sister didn't go the art school route.
No. So you, obviously, As you got a little older and you had this natural creative inclination, how did you make that journey from living in Surrey to deciding that art school would be for you? Because for some, that journey was kind of complicated, and for others, very easy.
I never thought that I would do anything else because one was drawing all the time. I've got sketchbooks now that I've kept where I would be at a party and be drawing portraits of people. So yeah. I think I didn't really question about going to art school. And I must say, I don't know if it was being the third daughter, but it or just our family, but I didn't really... one always knew that one would have to make one's own way. Hmm. But I didn't really think ahead a lot about what I wanted to do. I just took the fact that I would go to art school and then see what happened.
And you went... I mean, you ended up at Goldsmiths. Did you go anywhere before that? Any sort of...
No, foundation? Because the pre-dip at that time was at Goldsmiths.
Of course, yes.
And it was fantastic.
And you did fine arts. You did a fine art degree and you graduated with that. So... on leaving Goldsmiths, or at least during the time you were there, what were you thinking? I mean, what did you just think that, well, at the end of it something will happen, or did you have a plan, or did a plan present itself?
No, I had to think, what shall I do? And I knew I wasn't cut out for teaching, and I wasn't going to be a painter. I was always much more, I was good at drawing and I loved the printmaking and things like that, and it's obvious now that one was leaning towards design rather than fine art, really. So I just worked at home. I thought I'll try fabric designs and take those around.
So this is working from home?
Yes,
on the kitchen table, probably,
yes,
or something.
Or my
like
bedroom
that.
Table.
Or bedroom
where
table,
I used to do my homework.
Yeah.
Yes, just I did that, and I went for the odd job, like a makeup artist at the BBC, which I failed the interview miserably because I wasn't the sort of chatty sort, and or whatever you needed to be. But so it was this sort of thing where I suppose deep down there was always this urge to do it myself, and then I helped my sister, who was teaching, but she also printed silk scarves, and I took over printing her scarves for her,
right,
and the process of dyeing and washing those, and while she went out to teach. So I did that for a while, and then I thought, I must make something to take to the shops and sell. You know, it was simple as that.
And that sort of started to lead on to accessories.
I made papier-mâché beads and painted them and mixed them with others and made what we called chokers at the time, choker necklaces and bracelets, and got my first big order from Miss Selfridge. And then I knitted berries, little tops, anything I could make myself.
Yeah.
But... after a while, I thought this is very sort of just, this will do for this 6 months and then the next 6 months. I want to do something more permanent. And that's where it coincided with sort of finding this lovely shirt.
Ah, yes, the Eureka shirt.
Yeah.
Tell me about that shirt, because I'm fascinated to know exactly what it was like.
Well, I think...
because it's obviously very important.
Yes, although I think it was just a beautiful sort of, a beautifully made shirt, very fine stitches, very fine cloth and sort of hairline stripes. I remember it was a brown stripe. But I think together with the shirt, it was finding a V-neck slipover and a pair of cotton trousers at this jumble sale. And I put them together and we put them on my boyfriend and I thought, this is a lovely outfit. And but anyway, that was the fun of jumble sailing and everything.
Yeah.
But I thought I'd like to make shirts. I can't,
But as you've described that, putting together those three elements, it sounds very much to me the genesis of actually much of what followed, because there is a kind of thread,
yes,
that runs through your work.
And also, I think, the business of loving to go to the jumbles and finding things that were old at that time, you know, little Victorian vases or crocodile handbags, or
now this would have been. Let's just this would have been either the early '70s or the late '60s.
Late '60s.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying because to relate it to something else because I seem to remember at that time there was quite an interesting. If we move over to another area, which is, if you like, film costume design, I seem to remember a lot of Ken Russell films, and I think Shirley Russell. I think that was his wife at the time, was a costume designer. And many of the productions that Ken Russell directed, particularly those for television, seemed to have a fantastic attention to period costume, better than I'd seen before, in that they seemed to be very authentic, and there seemed to be a kind of revival, rediscovery of that lovely quality that was, you know, the reason I asked you about the 50s is that, you know, I too was brought up in the 50s, and my memory of the 50s is minimal colour, natural colours, lots of kind of tweed and flannel, and, you know, it went with the palette of the period, and that's very appealing. It's got an appealing quality to it, you know, when you contrast it with what you can have now. You can have any colour in the whole world, so there's something rather restrained. But anyway, going back to your that period for you, just tell me about how...
I think it was sort of finding beauty in something that was well made. That's what, you know, that's why one found old things. It seemed to contrast with sort of new things. But also, whether it's just an intuitive sort of attraction to something that has an intrinsic quality, because, again, my mother would say, you know, you can have much better quality if I make your clothes. And she talked about these lovely Braemar cardigans that... And I remember going up to town, you know, to London, to be bought a twin set or something. And then my grandfather, her father, had lovely antique chess and things in his house. And because I think his brother or sister or something was involved with antiques and... So I think there's a certain... Even the... you know, Mum was rather proud of her parquet flooring.
Oh, yes.
You know, you couldn't wear your stilettos on that. So you had to be careful. And this thing about quality...
Yes.
Because I think also... I mean, in the 60s, there was a tremendous sort of turnaround in fashion, but... It was quite throwaway, and it didn't matter so much about the quality. It was the impact, wasn't it? That sort of revolution and change from the dreary
Absolutely,
sort of
yes.
middle-aged teenager of the 50s.
And,
but I came a decade after that, didn't I?
Yes, that's right. So having been inspired by this beautifully made shirt with all its resonance of... the past and so forth, you decided that you would, that's what you do, you make your own shirts, and and concentrate on the quality of the making and to see how that would happen. So what happened then? You started making these yourself or with a small group of machinists that would put them together for you?
Well, I'm actually not very sure whether I'd already started making my own shirts and blouses for women and taking them around at this point. I think I was doing that. The thing is, I always needed to be in control of the make of it. And even with the beads, I eventually had to sort of... organise outworkers to make those. So when it came to sort of the shirt, that was a case of sort of getting a pattern cutter and, you know, things. But at the beginning, I did actually get the patterns myself, adapt them. I used to do small lays and wrap elastoplast around my fingers because the scissors hurt to cut through so many layers.
Yes.
And then I, of course, found that I could buy a cutter. And so it really was sort of, you know.
So is it really very much a tiny operation?
Tiny.
And then you, when you got some examples, you hawked them around yourself?
How yes, that, yes, or, took them to...
To various shops. Outlets, like Joseph
and, Browns.
And Browns and Paul Smith. And well, Ralph Lauren also, correct me if I'm wrong, I seem to remember
yes.
that was...
Well, actually, in the archive I found, we were in there yesterday, and there's a shirt that has got a Browns label in, because they actually... didn't want my label. They insisted on theirs because
oh,
you know I wasn't.
And at that time, I think your label was sort of signature, wasn't it? It was a
yes.
It was
in fact,
very
at
loopy,
that time,
very loopy.
It was it wasn't. It was actually a printed label because
oh, okay.
you know to begin with,
yeah.
how could I
yeah,
even know about woven yeah. labels and so on?
But obviously, you found this niche market, and the shirts began to become very. Desirable.
Yes, it coincided with American shopkeepers coming over looking for sort of traditional English things, and obviously they like this sort of slightly fresh approach to the English tradition, because although I loved the quality of the cloth, I didn't like smart German street businessmen's shirts. You know, I liked casual, soft, crumpled shirts.
Yeah. So that obviously started to get your name banded around, even though, as you said, Browns were reluctant to use your own name. But presumably, gradually, that
yes,
changed.
Yes, that changed.
And
I think Joseph was one of the first that really liked the shirts. Oh, for women, I'm jumping here,
yeah.
because I think I started with shirts for women, didn't find much of a market for that, and it was the men's shirts that then really took hold.
Yeah.
And that's where I really was able to start building a workroom of skilled machinists.
Yeah.
And I learned an awful lot from this really quite an elderly machinist. And that was great fun for me, learning about it and building the workroom.
And then, I mean, after that, you know, blossoming, you went on to open your first menswear shop in on South Moulton Street.
Yes, that was a franchise with Joseph.
With Joseph.
Yes, he.
Yeah.
I used to sell the men's clothes to him, shirts, then a jacket, then trousers, and he said, when you've made a complete men's outfit, I'll open a shop for you. And he did.
That's true.
And I was working with my husband then, and we... took care of all the graphics and the interior of the shop, and Joseph just put the money up, and we were a very happy marriage.
That's very good.
Yeah.
And then a little later in 1980, you branched out into women's wear more fully. I mean, you said that, you know, early on you started with women's shirts, but obviously then
yes.
the male side dominated.
Well, you see, women started to come in and buy the men's jackets and trousers
yeah.
because it was the Annie Hall days. And
of course, yeah.
Well,
it's film again. Interesting mm. that...
Well, films and fashion always
they
seem
really
to connect,
sort of,
don't they?
They do, yeah. Mm. So 1980 must have really been a good period. You were
that was
really
probably the period where one was after the first decade sort of thing was
yeah.
really successful, so-called, you know, as
yeah.
Press and I think Browns, Joseph and we were the sort of shops to go to then.
Yeah.
I think
yeah. And then you were among the first of the British designers to find success in Japan, and I think I was checking just yesterday, and I noticed that you have over 30 outlets, whether they're complete shops or within shops. I'm unsure, including a lifestyle shop, which I was interested to see. That's quite interesting.
Well, there are.
I mean, it's interesting in that part of that. Is very evident here in the shop, but this seemed to be much more sort of established with more products and So is that something that you get very involved with, the selection of all of the
yes,
items that go into that lifestyle shop?
I mean, the Japanese licensee has been tremendous for us, but it's taken an awful lot of sort of communication and control and understanding from the chap who set it up, Sam Suguri. I mean, he's like a friend, and without his sort of patience, I don't know, but he's been very clever, and he grew the business very carefully. He got many sort of requests to open lots of places, but he didn't. He grew it slowly and kept the quality, and we've got this very good reputation for quality in Japan. And we've got about three fairly large lifestyle shops, and then over 40 to 50 outlets.
Much as that. Wow.
And they are mostly concessions in stores.
Yes.
Quite big concessions, very good. Some of them very successful.
So is that, I mean, clearly Japan is a very successful area for it. I can understand that, because I can see the Japanese being very attracted to your clothes, as they always have been to, you know, a certain classicism, if you know what I mean. There's something about the certain niche of the Japanese that seem to love, you know, they'll go to, I mean, years ago, I think Burberry's had an outlet in Hanover Square that made small size raincoats, you know, because such was the turnover of those kind of traditional things. So I it seems to fit. But is that your biggest market, Japan? Would you?
Oh yes,
without doubt. Because from what I understand, you're quite a media person there. I mean, having only met you sort of really once before, I think the image. One would have an image of a fashion designer, or whatever you like to term yourself, as being someone very kind of gushing and outgoing. But you're, in fact, thinking about it, the sort of image of the interior of your shop and the exterior is very much, it seems to me, a reflection of you. It's kind of discreet, has a quiet quality, and really the work speaks for itself, it seems to me. So how do you find it in Japan if you've got a lot of people wanting to chat to you and so forth?
Well, I hated it one time when I went, and I just got off the long-haul flight, and someone came up and said, "Are you Margaret Chow?" And you're feeling really... Yeah. No, I don't like being recognised at all. We keep much more control now on the PR. It's much more meaningful now to, you know, relevant product or timings of various things. I had faith in Sam running the business. I realised without them slightly sort of commercialising what I do here, I wouldn't have been able to carry on doing exactly what I wanted to do here.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I think, you know, you're right in saying that the shop does reflect oneself is that it was a conscious decision, really, towards the end of the 90s. From the beginning of the 90s, we opened several little shops, and the business became much more stable, being run by Richard, and the Japanese took over the company then, actually. So everything was much more stable and well organised, but it was becoming a little bit retail-led.
Yes.
And it was losing its sort of creative spark, as far as I was concerned. At the same time, on the street, there were, Bond Street changed with all these enormous American companies coming in. There was tremendous sort of marketing power, which we could never have.
Yeah.
And I thought the success for me has always been to, you know, do something personally. It's a personal statement, really. And so coming here, finding this lovely space, was a great way to sort of bring everybody together, have almost the Margaret Howe workshop, if you like. And at that time, the company had got to a certain size where I needed design assistants to work on the collections. And so therefore delegating design of the clothing to a certain extent. And I wanted to put it in my own ambience, if you like. And I was sort of collecting bits of design that I liked or was interested in. And I thought, well, let's feed that in to the shop.
Which
and
is,
in
I think
with the furniture.
There are other fashion designers that have done that, but none of them, in my view, have done it with the kind of attention to detail and clear passion that you have. I think that they've decided that, you know, lifestyle or home section they would love, and they just have someone buy a whole lot of stuff. Whereas I think your pieces, you know, on the occasions that I've been to the store over the years, it's always a pleasure because you come in, you know, to look through the clothes, and you're struck by either posters or pieces of typography that you've got framed, and then pieces of classic 20th century furniture, or indeed new pieces. You know, I bought one of Matthew Hilton's table lamps from here. They all feed back into the very period that I think that you very much love. You know, this kind of good, solid, practical British 20th century design that actually you can mix and match with modern pieces, and it all fits. It kind of is timeless, and that seems to me to also reflect in your own work. You know, that it's all come together, and they all feed off one another. So, looking at your outside today, you've got the pieces that you've. I'm talking now about the furnishing pieces that you've helped develop, or if you like. Reintroduce. You've encouraged companies to, you know, Anglepoys and Ernest Race and Urquhart to, you know, to actually delve into their archives and say, you know, okay. Now, I can't believe for one moment that this is a highly profitable area for you at all, because, you know, knowing that world, the world of furniture, it's such a cutthroat, high volume business that, you know, it's amazing that people can survive. But so I see it seems to set off the atmosphere of the shop, and it sort of says, well, this is me, this is what you know. It's not just about the clothes that you wear, it's about the life that you lead and the things you put into the spaces that you live in.
Well, also it's like when you suddenly, well, it is almost sort of a sudden thing when I went to a little shop in Shoreditch called Undercurrents, and they had a round coffee table, Urquhart, and a little chair. And you suddenly see it afresh.
Yeah.
And it was so simple and elegant, really. And I used to drive past the second-hand shop on the way to Battersea. That's where we used to have the studio. And there was always, you know, something. And I started to collect the Urquhart. I thought that would be brilliant because it's such a British institution.
Very much
and
so.
And you want to show it to other people. I mean, of course, you know, a few other people see it as well, but our customers, no end came in and said, but, you know, we had things like that when I was growing up. And, you know, it does open.
It does.
I thought, and it was also because America, Scandinavia, was getting a lot of publicity about their design, and so they should, but we also have some good designers, and I thought, well, my clothes are very sort of always termed very British, so let's concentrate on British designers, product designers that might have been a bit overlooked. And so, you know, the things one was finding now were pieces of stainless steel, Robert Welsh in charity shops and things like that. And the beautiful thing. So, that's really.
Is this very much then reflected in your own home? I mean, have you filled it with an eclectic mix of 20th century British bits and pieces. So you, yes. This is just an overspill into your. You're just bringing your life into your workspace as well.
It is really in a way, but it. But here, one's trying to do it with a purpose, and you know, to put on the little exhibitions, and then with Urkel, it led on to actually reproducing some pieces with them, which was nice.
Yes.
And then there is, you know, Joe Barber, who helps me here on that side of things, sourcing, and we source new product, but in the same sort of way. We try and find people who are almost sort of craftsmen, but making something that is modern and practical and rather than just sort of pretty pots or...
Yes.
I didn't want meaningless home product. I wanted something that was very well designed and useful.
Well, I think, you know, going back to the, you know, the wartime period and the utility furniture, it was all very practical and, you know, functional. And, you know, a lot of it was also attractive too. But it lasts forever. Mm. You can, you know, go to anyone's... I bet you can go to anyone's house and... In this country, and you'll find some that characteristic little sign stamped on the back, still being working out. The other thing that I noticed, you've been involved in a kind of a reassessment of span housing, which is something you're interested in. And I remember myself many, many years ago, a very good documentary. There was a terrific architectural writer and journalist called Ian Nairn, who I'm sure
you know. Mm.
And he made a program about span housing.
Oh,
he used to drive around his little Morris Minor.
They were great programs, always used
fantastic
to watch.
Fantastic programs. Mm. He wore a kind of Macintosh and little hat, but he was very eloquent and terrific. And I remember him, you know, this is a long time ago, talking about span houses and the rationale and so forth. And it kind of leads me on to, for me, the kind of, if you like, the tragedy of domestic architecture in this country. I mean, I was a couple of weeks ago in Amsterdam, and I went over to along the riverside, where there's you know, nothing but contemporary architecture. Absolutely wonderful. Mm. I mean, they really know how to use light, space, and create an intimacy without, you know, as we seem to do, reverting to a kind of some kind of nostalgic Poundbury sort of situation. And I think the span houses were really one of the last attempts at trying to use, you know, good architecture for domestic use and thinking about the people that were going to live in those houses and not just, you know, packing them in and making as much money per unit, as they call them, as possible. It's, and I think you sponsored an exhibition, or you...
We did, because... Well, we support Open House.
Yes, the yearly architectural.
Yes, because when you're a company, you're always sort of being asked to donate to charity. And we thought, well, let's do it for some. I mean, I remember when it started, having the most terrific, exciting weekend, visiting all these places. And I think it's a great thing, Open House.
Mm.
So we try and put on an event at the beginning of that weekend, and but with Span, it became, you know, so it just extended into a little exhibition using some of the photographs from the RIBA archive and things.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they put on a lovely exhibition of Span.
They did, yes.
But I was surrounded by the Span Estates in Blackheath, and again, when I first lived there, used to walk past, and I wouldn't have liked to have lived in them, you know. Then the years go by, and you suddenly assess them again, and they're really very nicely designed.
It's actually quite interesting, that reassessment, because, you know, a lot of, just as buildings are about to be pulled down,
yes,
they're rediscovered by a whole new generation, that seems to be. So many of the 60s office buildings that, you know, were not getting a look in at all. People just felt they were just put up. Have, you know, certainly been completely reassessed in their quality and the visual aspect and so forth, and are kind of beloved by much younger people. And that is the same with in so many areas. I mean, certainly in furniture, interior styling. I mean, in interior styling, you know, I think when you get to a certain age and you've been there and you see these things being regurgitated and reassessed and so forth, I always find that very interesting, the way that there's this continual handing on of something from the past, but adding a bit to it and then reinventing it, and then it goes. And I wondered whether there has ever been anything truly original in terms of design. I mean, I think one could think of the Bauhaus, which was a kind of a moment, which is, you know, total stripping back, you know, functionality and form and, you know, lack of any decoration as being, you know, a major inspiration to many, many people. But it's quite difficult now. You know, when you look at, you know, the impact that 60s, particularly large-scale architecture, is kind of having again on. You know, I think of Zaha Hadid and her work, and it's very much reminiscent of the Brazilian, the famous Brazilian architect, whose name escapes me at the moment. In, you know, I look at them and I see complete sort of parallels. It's quite interesting. The way that, anyway, I digress.
Well, I just think it's madness that we can't sort of build more practical, simple houses that could be really aesthetically pleasing. But it's changing the public's attitude to that, isn't it?
I saw a programme fairly recently where they took a group of British people who had a very fixed views on what a house should be like across the Holland, to the very place that I went to look at these, and their first reaction was, oh, they all look a bit sort of officey, and but the moment they were inside and they saw how they used space and light, they changed their tune. The alternative was Poundbury in Dorset, which is where Prince Charles has created this very large now, because I live not very far away, sort of new town, but it's built on a organic village-like structure with little architectural, you know, town halls and towers and clocks and God knows what else.
But pillars and architraves.
What's so depressing is that, one, every time they build a house itself, instantly, and two, when you look at the detailing, it's all wrong. I mean, all the windows are too high because of regulation, all that sort of stuff, or the glazing bars are too thick because they're going to be double. And I think, well, if you're going to do that, if you really are going to do that, do it absolutely perfectly with great integrity. You know, recreate something that's absolutely as it was in the Georgian period, not a half-hearted attempt. But it doesn't seem to affect the public. They love it. I think there is a great nostalgia within the British people. You know, there is a sort of almost a paint-by-numbers view of what interior should look like.
Yes, and yet, you know, with all the young couples that moved into these span houses, they just fell in love with them because they worked.
Yes.
You know, the light does affect you. The there does have to be a nice sort of human element to architecture, doesn't it? Domestic architecture,
absolutely,
especially.
Well, I think it should be the same with offices, personally.
Yes.
I think it all gets lost. You know, forget the people, think about the statement, which is very sad.
I mean, there the beauty was all the landscape. It was all the landscaping. I mean, the whole thing was considered as,
inside and outside,
like a small village, but in the town. I mean, it was perfect.
Yeah, and different levels. And
yes,
it's such a pity that
sort of
we're
modular,
not
but enough individuality somehow.
Yeah.
And also, it's happened on the Greenwich Peninsula, I find, where you get these ghastly sort of high-rise, well, flats that are all crudely painted on the outside, and lots of fussiness, and yet The Yacht Club has been designed with lovely horizontal wood and glass, and very simple and perfect for the environment. Mm.
Well, like the rowing club that Chipperfield designed at the other end of the Thames, which is just simple wood. It's sad that that it's not. I know that I think CABE are trying to create a greater awareness of domestic architecture, modern domestic architecture. It'll be very interesting to see whether they can achieve something over the coming years.
It is a difficult thing to change people's attitude to.
Yes, it is. Well, I'm going to sort of round off now, but last year, 2007, was a really good year for you because you were made a CBE at the beginning in the New Year's Honours list, and then later you became a Royal Designer towards the end of the year. So it rounded off a nice time for you. So, I mean, all that hard work, going right back to when you found that little shirt, seems to have paid off. And I wanted to end, really, by just asking you, because no doubt there will be some young budding designers, fashion designers, or anyone that wants to get into the creative world, either about to go to college or at college. I wonder whether you have any kind of words of wisdom that you'd like to pass on to them.
Well, I think if you've got a strong drive to do something, money isn't the drive. You've got to want to do it wholeheartedly and stick at it, because it's very hard, lots of tears. I think it's just a staying power. It's just keeping up that enthusiasm for what you do.
Hmm. Well, Margaret Howell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.